From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. World leaders gathered this weekend to see what they could do to stop the financial bleeding worldwide. And we look at the state of retail sales. Businesses are in trouble. Does that mean more holiday deals? Dr. Julianne Malveaux is here to help us understand the latest in money matters. She's an economist and the president of Bennett College. Hi, Dr. Malveaux.
Hi, Farai. How are you?
I'm good. More tough news. President Bush organized a summit of the G20 leaders this weekend, and those are the 20 biggest global economies, including China, which launched a huge financial stimulus program. This comes at a really continuingly tough time. Citigroup says it's going to slash more than 50,000 positions. Japan says it's formally in a recession. In light of this kind of news, what came out of that meeting?
There was a significant amount of tension in the meeting with France, with the French talking about more collective rules and with Mr. Bush talking about the free market. The question of how do you regulate capitalism was really on front and center in the conversation. How do you begin to regulate? Should you regulate? And so all they agreed to do was to talk again. However, it was important to have this meeting. It was not just a meeting of the top 20 economies, Farai. It really was a more integrated meeting than we've seen in a long time, with people, countries who might not have otherwise been at the table sitting there, Brazil, some others. And so we're beginning to see the 21st century from a demographic perspective that we've not seen before.
Do you think that this is really... is this going to affect everyday folks in the U.S. anytime soon, even if, say, people who are part of this large international coalition pull together? Is this going to produce short-term changes, or even if it works, will it be down the road?
I don't think that there are any short-term changes in the works from this conversation that was held this weekend. I think that every individual country has the possibility of their own short-term changes. But first of all, trying to get everyone on the same page and then to move in lockstep is going to be very difficult. I think what the meeting this weekend reminded us is how intertwined we are. But at the same time, when have you last heard someone in the United States speak about poverty? So if we look at this, poverty is not on the front burner. It's capital markets that are on the front burner. When does it trickle down to the hood? Not until the hood asks for it.
All right, let's talk more about domestic issues. Things have changed with the bailout plan, and there's this idea that you can really move this bailout plan to free up credit. How does that affect people? First of all, this bailout plan really has not been set in stone even now. But when we talk about freeing up credit, what does that really mean?
We're talking about the fact that lots of Americans are overextended and how we might provide them with opportunities not to wreck their credit, but perhaps to give them some of the same opportunities that banks and others are having. You're right. This thing is not set in stone. Henry Paulson came in with three pages of handwritten notes as a justification for $700 billion. The fluidity of his proposal is very clear now. It started out as being banks and Wall Street. Now we have the auto people. We've got a whole lot of other people saying, what about us? The only constituency that is not being represented is the constituency of the poor. Even if you did a 90-day to 120-day foreclosure freeze, half of all black folks rent. So that would not affect them. Half of all Latinos rent. It would not affect them. Most poor people rent. So we're looking at something that is sitting on shifting sand. And in sitting on shifting sand, I think it's raising the hackles of most voters. And we'll see what happens in this lame duck session that begins tomorrow.
Do you have any idea what's happening with the real estate markets? I mean, I've read reports that in New York, which is one of this a very unusual market, things have not changed a lot so far. But in most cities, they have sometimes dramatically double-digit drops in the prices of homes. Anything we can say about what we're seeing on that level?
What we know is that the borrowing against home equity, the skyrocketing of home prices over the past 5 years, 20% at a time, All of this has been fake and not real, and so we're seeing markets readjust themselves. Of course, New York real estate with international buyers bidding for it, San Francisco as well, possibly LA. There are a few markets where you're going to see some stability, but by and large, you're going to see property values drop, and they're going to continue to drop. If I were about to buy, I'd hold on to my money and wait for about 3 months to see what happens. There are lots of opportunities for people with cash, but for people without cash, you have lots of opportunities to lose ground.
All right. Speaking on 60 Minutes last night, CBS show, President-elect Barack Obama said the nation had few options left but to increase federal spending. Here's what he said.
I think what's interesting about the time that we're in right now is that you actually have a consensus among conservative, Republican-leaning economists and liberal left-leaning economists. And the consensus is this, that we have to do whatever it takes to get this economy moving again. That we're going to have to spend money now to stimulate the economy, and that we shouldn't worry about the deficit next year or even the year after.
What do you make of that? The idea we shouldn't worry about the deficit, that we have to spend money. Do you think he's right that there will be a consensus, a bipartisan consensus on that?
I hope there will be a consensus because I think he is right. We have to create jobs. We've shed 1.2 million jobs in the last year. We've got to replicate some of those jobs. We've got to do the infrastructure thing, which pumps money into the economy. Yes, we have to spend, but there's a difference, Farai, between spending on something like a war, where's the return, and spending on something like infrastructure, human beings. You see the return. You see it in terms of people paying more taxes. You see it in terms of cities and towns looking stronger and better. The conventional wisdom has been don't spend, and the previous administration has not spent on human and social services, but spent on other things. So now I think the president-elect is saying, let's look at ways we can jumpstart this economy. And that's his biggest priority, is to jumpstart the economy. And it means putting money into it.
What about the auto bailout issue? We mentioned that briefly just talking today. But when you have auto sales dropping for various manufacturers, some of them dropping 20-odd percent, some of them dropping 40-odd percent in the past month, that is almost unthinkable. It just means that people are holding on tight to their, you know, their hoopties and praying for the best, praying that the oil change will keep it going. Is it in America's interest, and in what way, rather, would it be in this country's interest to invest in the auto industry and keeping it alive?
The word you use that is most critical is invest. I don't think that there should be a bailout where we just give the auto folks money and say we lend it to them and don't collect. I think that if we think this industry is going to bounce back, and it must, it's one of our core industries, then we have to talk about investment. I think we also work against ourselves if we decide that on one hand we want to boost up auto, on the other hand we want to have a green agenda. If the two of those go hand in hand, then perhaps we ought to impose some conditionalities on the industry to say, moving forward, as we manufacture more cars, they're more environmentally friendly and things like that. I just hope that we don't do what we've done in the past, which is throw money at industries that we think are not doing well. If we're going to talk about restructuring our economy, then we really have to talk about having some say over the ways we invest and what these companies do moving forward.
What about states? There are, well, states and municipalities. You have some governors looking to tax hikes. Governor Schwarzenegger in California wants to look at hiking the sales tax. Nevada, is looking at gasoline. When you think about these basic issues of sales, gasoline, how do they affect people who are poor and working class differently than people who are wealthy?
Well, they obviously hit people at the bottom just more harshly. We're looking at what we call regressive taxes. In other words, there's so much money you're going to spend on groceries. And so if you talk about a basic tax, the people who spend proportionally more of their income on groceries are also going to spend proportionally more in taxes. Ditto auto or gasoline prices. You know, there just is a limit to how much you can spend on those things. While I understand the sentiment of mayors and governors, they've got to get revenue too. They're seeing the same drop in tax revenues that the federal government is seeing. And in addition, in many, many cases, they have laws that prevent them from floating deficits while the federal government can. So they've got to pay year by year. They've got to pay one way or another, and I understand that. But maybe what should be offered, if we can relieve Wall Street, what about cities and states? What can we do to allow these cities and states to do some short-term borrowing so that they cannot essentially imperil us? Here's the deal. If we do any kind of tax cuts and bailouts at the federal level, but the states come to take it back, it will not be economic stimulus.
All right, a quick hit. Is it a good time to go buy retail goods?
If you have cash. I mean, if you have cash, you're in the catbird seat. If you have cash, you see things that you wanted 3 or 4 months ago that are now maybe a third less than they are. Every retailer, if you have all these credit cards, you're getting things in the mail with coupons that are 20, 30, and 40% off. If you have cash, it's a good time to jump into the retail goods market. But be careful. Be extraordinarily careful. Don't let the fact that you have cash let you overextend yourself and look at where you're going in the future. Here's what I'd like to see people do. Make a list. What do you want to do? What do you need? How much money are you going to spend on Christmas, Thanksgiving? Who do you want to give gifts to? And then go out there and enjoy the sales. But don't go out to experience the sales if you don't have the dollars for them. The sales are there. Oh, they're absolutely there. Retailers are excited. But you've got to be the master of your money.
All right, Dr. Malveaux. Thanks.
Thank you.
Dr. Julianne Malveaux is an author, economist, and News and Notes contributor. She's also president of Bennett College and joined us from the studios of WFDD in Greensboro, North Carolina. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. There were fierce rivals in the Democratic primary, but President-elect Barack Obama is now considering Senator Hillary Clinton for a top position in his cabinet. And we've talked about folks around the world celebrating the Obama win, but some international reactions have been icy or downright racist. We've got these stories and more on today's Bloggers Roundtable with Rob Redding of Redding News Review, Patrice Yersick of Afrobella.com, and Charles Robinson of Charles Black Politics Blog. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
So, since Mr. Obama's election to the White House, he's named John Podesta as the head of the White House transition team. Podesta used to be President Bill Clinton's chief of staff. Now, some news sources report that 31 of Obama's 47 appointments have ties to the Clinton administration. Charles, with these kind of appointments, can Obama still claim the slogan, change you can believe in, or should it be Clinton Redux?
And I think part of it is that we don't really have anybody who's appointed. We have a lot of names that have been floated out. And yes, he's had to look at the Clinton administration in order to get his ducks in a row because they've done it before. Understand that if you go in here blind, you can get landslided, if you will, if you don't know how to set up. Clinton had that problem when he decided late in his transition to appoint some of the major figures in his cabinet. Think about this. We're in the middle of an economic crisis, and we got two wars going on. You don't want to start on day one. You need to start, you know, a month ahead of time.
So it sounds like you think that this is a good idea, that he's got some experience there.
Well, it's not necessarily a good idea, but it's the most prudent idea. Think about it. You got to know what to do. And if you've never done it before, why not call on the people who have at least tried it and at least had some success at it, as opposed to going in and say, okay, we're going to restart all over and we're going to shift the decks on the Titanic. Guess what? The ship is still going to go down. What you want is somebody who can at least get the ship moving in the right direction, as opposed to trying to ask, what do we do now?
There's also a lot of speculation about the cabinet, and so we had our first interview with Mr. Obama last night on 60 Minutes, and here's what he said about his cabinet.
You met with Senator Clinton this week?
I did.
Is she on the short list for a cabinet position?
You know, she is somebody who I needed advice and counsel from. She is one of the most thoughtful public officials that we have. Beyond that, you're not getting anything out of me, Steve.
Will it be Republicans in the cabinet?
Yes.
More than one?
You're not getting any more out of me.
That was very to the point. Patrice, what do you think of both the Clinton issue, whether or not Senator Hillary Clinton could be a good Secretary of State, and also the bipartisan issue?
I mean, I think it proves that Obama's really trying to take a page out of Lincoln's book by not just saying he's a bipartisan candidate, but he's proving it. He's doing whatever it takes to get America out of the crisis that it's in. I think it's wonderful to have a president who is proud to make considered decisions and is open to dissenting opinion for a change.
Rob, there's also the meeting with Senator John McCain. Although the meeting has happened, not a lot of news has come out yet about what actually they said. But what role do you think Senator McCain could play? And I'm not talking about necessarily an official role, but is having Senator McCain be a friendly to the Obama White House important?
Oh, I think it is. I think it is also important that he play a role. I can definitely see him as defense secretary, and I think that he's deserving of such a post. In addition to that, I think he probably is more deserving of a Secretary of State role than perhaps Hillary Clinton is. I mean, if you didn't think Hillary Clinton, if some people out there didn't think she was qualified to be President of the United States, she's clearly not qualified to be Secretary of State. But I digress. Charles, look, I was looking to support you to be the first press secretary. I'm surprised you want all this old blood in the White House.
Well, no, Rob, not this time. I think, look, one of the things we've learned anything about the Obama campaign is they don't let things leak. Think about how you learned about the vice president. You know, it was a text message. So I'm assuming if you're on that text message list, you'll be getting the rollout of who the appointees are. But getting back to this thing about John McCain, let me say that, you know, that old adage, you know, you keep your friends close, but you keep your enemies closer. I think that's one of those adages, if you will, that's being played out here. Because in the end, you at least know where the arguments are coming from. And, you know, not only did he have John McCain there, but he also had Senator Lindsey Graham there, who, you know, I don't care if Mitch McConnell is the leader of the Republican Party. Guess what? Those two got their finger on the pulse of the Republican Party as it's configured at this moment.
All right, Patrice, I want to move us on to this question of international reaction. There were a lot of people around the world, whether they were world leaders or individual people, who were dancing in the street when Obama was elected. And some of it has to do very much with the questions of America's place in the world, not just mm-hmm. Obama himself. But there have been some salty or strange moments. The Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi called Barack Obama young, handsome, and even suntanned. He was criticized for that statement and insisted it
ignorance
was a compliment.
Ignorance is bliss.
Yeah. So what do you think, Patrice? Was this just, you know, Afrobella does beauty coverage. Was this just a beauty
yes.
moment, or was this something more?
It's a moment of ignorance. I don't know if it can be termed beauty at all. I think, you know, there's going to be some uncomfortable moments like this. People are now going to have to learn. People who have not had to learn how to address, you know, people of color are going to have to. And, you know, even though Obama's victory was a huge step forward for equal rights, we're going to see racism pop up abroad, at home, in places that you may not have expected before. And, you know, we're living in really interesting times. It must be a very frightening time to be a racist and to be afraid of people of color.
Well,
you mean frightening? Are you kidding me? This is kind of like a racist dream. You know, they are using this as the poster child of why we need to take things back. I believe it was a German newspaper that actually was, you know, that it had some really scurrilous things to say about the president.
Well, let me point out a couple more, and I think this is maybe what you're referring to. There's a journalist in Austria who told his audience, he was on air, "I think Americans are still racist and they must be very badly off to so spectacularly send a black man to the White House." And there was a Polish lawmaker who reportedly said in a speech, quote, "This marks the end of the white man's civilization. Fear wow. of a black planet." So, yeah. Charles, sounds like what you're saying is you know, we've got some grounds for
Rob,
that.
Are you still in Louisiana? Because I could have heard this in Louisiana as well.
And, well, you do and, you hear know, it in Louisiana. And let me just tell you, someone that came into a restaurant earlier, I'm understanding, was told because he was wearing a Barack Obama T-shirt that he couldn't get service there. And that kind of thing is going on. Look, you know, this Austrian journalist also said something even more interesting. He also said that, you know, this is a situation where I don't think blacks are qualified to run anything, including a government. And he said, if that sounds like a racist statement, it is. Look, I think this is very cut and dry. I think that the world is having to deal with something that we've been doing over at R&R for a while, and that is deal with black issues as it relates to something that was on the back burner is now on the front burner, and the concept of what is niche news has changed. What was niche news yesterday is no longer niche news today. It is important that we deal with these issues, get them out on the table, and flesh them out. And these are not just little happenstance, just fly-by-night comments. These are long-held thoughts that need to be dealt with.
Patrice, this is a little bit of a digression, but I was watching one of the shows on one of the premium cable channels, and a white character just sort of tossed off the N-word. And it just struck me that that was something that, that would not have happened 10 years ago on television. But I'm also wondering if the kind of casual assumption that it's okay for everyone to, you know, sort of play in the racial sandbox is also going to affect pop culture.
I'm hoping to see some real change in the pop culture arena in terms of, like, now we've got a black president. Are we going to finally start seeing some black sitcom characters or some black people starring on their own television shows? And, you know, I mean, and on the runways, you know, in fashion, there's going to be a change, I think. It's going to be a gradual change, but, you know, these kinds of things, the uncomfortable moments are going to come at the beginning. And I'm hoping that as Obama leads, you know, things will really change in a positive way.
It sounds like go ahead.
I was going to say, on the world stage, you know, this busts the caricature that American media has sent out to the world, if you will. I mean, I know that in some Asian countries, you know, we are portrayed as buffoonish and whatever else. And that's not universal. But those images that are being sent out are now being refuted by a person who is literally, you know, the most powerful man on the planet.
So do you think, though, that will take people who may be uncomfortable with this kind of change and make them kind of fire off more volleys, or do you think it's something where people will evolve?
I think they have to evolve. It's a new day. You can't look, if you want to play the game the old way, you're not going to be a player in the game. If you want to move forward, then, you know, one of the things I keep hearing from Muslim countries is that we wish we had an Obama type character, someone who is from a minority, so that we could bring new blood into the process. And I think that is the hope that Obama brings to the world, that minorities in other governments across the world will have to recognize these minorities within their own country.
All right. I want to remind everyone who we're talking to. Charles Robinson writes Charles Black Politics blog. Patrice Urasick blogs at Afrobella.com. Rob Redding runs the blog Redding News Review. This, of course, is our bloggers roundtable on NPR's News and Notes. Rob, there's been a controversy on the religious front. In South Carolina, a Catholic priest told his parishioners they shouldn't take communion if they voted for Barack Obama. The president-elect supports abortion rights. And the priest wrote in a letter to parishioners they are putting their souls at risk if they take Holy Communion before doing penance for their vote. So does that cross the line between politics and religion?
Absolutely. And the reason why is because another part of that letter, I believe, referred to him as Barack Hussein Obama, his full name. And people do that typically to slight him. In addition to that, it also said there were other choices that could have been made that implied that there should have been a choice there for the flip-flopping John McCain on the same issue. I think it's very cut and dry that this is inappropriate. It's political, and it has no place in the pulpit in America.
Charles, many American Catholics actually support some forms of abortion rights, although the church takes a very, very firm stance that abortion is completely morally wrong in all circumstances. Do you think this could actually prompt, or situations like this could prompt American Catholics to have more of an internal dialogue?
I think it's been going on for some time. You know, you think back to John Kerry when he was told that by a priest that he would not give him the sacrament. I think part of it is that, you know, religion is butting up against the 21st century as to who you are and what you are, as opposed to being the end-all, the be-all. I think, I don't want to say enlightened folks, but, you know, those folks who say, wait a minute, I don't want to say you pick and choose which part of religion that you want to adhere to. But I think in the Catholic community, I know that that's been going on. People have decided, well, I agree with the stance against capital punishment, but I don't agree with the thing on abortion. And you have to balance those two issues, and you got to go, well, which one do you want to go with? And I think at the end of the day, though, it'll be some rethinking. But we often have religious leaders say stuff. You go like, you kidding me? Did you just hear what you said? I mean, I've heard Baptists, I've heard Protestants, I've even heard Jewish leaders say some things that you go like, I can't believe you said that.
Patrice, another issue. Inauguration. Everybody wants a ticket. Tens of thousands of requests are coming into congressional offices. They're the main folks giving out the tickets, and then you've got the senators giving out some, and of course, a few patrons get some. But there are going to be estimated 1 million people in Chocolate City. For the inauguration. It sounds good for the tax base, but would you want to go? Would you want to deal with the crowds and the hassle?
I would love to be there. I wished I was at Grant Park. I would love to be there. I mean, just to be able to tell your children or your grandchildren that you were there to witness that history in person would be incredible. But, I'm going to be one of the million plus people watching from around the world. And it's also my husband's birthday, so I plan on throwing a big party. I'm very excited for January 20th.
Look, tell him he can stay at my house. I live outside of Washington. I'm only going to charge you $1,000 to sleep on my pull-out sofa.
Yeah.
And it's a bargain.
Charles, you're not joking.
I'm not joking.
Because these prices, like on Craigslist, and I mean, the hotels are gone. It's a wrap.
Right. To give you an example, both of them, both Washington and Baltimore, you don't even think about a hotel. I had a guy who said he found a hotel. It was $700 a night. It was in a town called Hagerstown, which is about a good 45 miles outside of Washington. But he lived in Baltimore. I told him, stay home, catch the train over. The interesting part is that if you got any kind of space, people are giving it up. I've gotten at least 3 emails this morning saying, if you know somebody who wants to come, I got an extra room, I got an extra apartment. And yes, we're anticipating not just, the person who's got a ticket, but think about this, people are getting on buses coming here. I mean, the closest thing I can remind myself of is when the Million Man March happened. And, they made all the buses stay outside of Washington, and you had to get on public transportation to get into the city. We're talking, I'm thinking 2 million folks. I've got a relative who's in law enforcement. He says, we don't know what to expect. And understand you got to get a ticket to get to the mall. But as soon as the mall is over with, Pennsylvania Avenue. And I'm telling you, that's the free fall.
Do not take a taxi. I can say after living in Washington.
Not trying to take a taxi.
It'll take you for what used to be maybe a 5-minute ride. First of all, you won't go anywhere. You won't even get, a couple of inches. Yeah. And then you'll be charged a ton of money. Rob, would you go? Would you want to go?
Rob's going to stay with me. I figured if Rob's going to call me and say, Charles, can I sleep on your
sofa? I was going to say, I don't know if you've got any space, Charles, but I've got the floor. So I can't wait.
Oh, wow. All right, guys, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We were talking to Rob Redding, who maintains the blog Redding News Review, Patrice Yursik, who blogs at afrobella.com. She was at WLRN in Miami, and Charles Robinson, who writes Charles Black Politics blog. He was at WEAA in Baltimore, Maryland, and you can find links to their website at ours, nprnewsandviews.org. And next on News and Notes, we talk to the writer of a one-man show about his own life entertaining troops in the Air Force, and we also talk with a woman who spent decades fighting to help children, Marion Wright Edelman. I'm I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. If you think of the Air Force, you might think, well, airplanes. That seems logical. You might think of aircraft carriers, combat, and the airmen and women who put their lives at risk. All of that is true, of course, but what about entertainment? The Air Force puts on a serious traveling variety show. A man named Khalil Ashanti went to some of the toughest places in the world to entertain his fellow airmen and women. Now he's turned his Air Force experience into an off-Broadway one-man show called Basic Training. Khalil, welcome.
Hello. Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing great. So describe what people see when they come to Basic Training.
When people come to Basic Training, they're kind of immersed in this interactive theater world where they get to see my journey. The night before I left for Basic Training, I found out that the guy who had abused me my entire life wasn't my real dad. And my mom swears she told me before. She said I probably just forgot. And so me, in trying to leave this childhood behind, I begin this journey of joining the military and trying to forget it all. But while I'm in the military, I end up trying out for Tops in Blue, which is an international competition of talent. Everyone, if you think G.I. Jane meets American Idol on
wow.
steroids, that's what Tops in Blue is. And it's serious stuff. It's a lot of fun. There's a little breakdancing, a little pop locking. And once again, it's very interactive. It's very much a very different theater experience.
You know, we had on Brian Copeland, who has a very successful one-man show called Not a Genuine Black Man, and also dealing with some really very harsh realities of his childhood. It strikes me that, you know, that's got to be part of what shaped you as a person who's able to do, what is it? How many characters do you have in this show?
23 characters.
23 characters.
No, I mean, costume changes, no props.
Did you go into being someone who could be so mutable, in part because you had to have a place to escape, I'm assuming.
I think that's exactly what it was. I remember as a teenager, you know, I was born in Germany, lived in Japan till I was 10, and then, you know, moved to Iowa, which is where I graduated high school. But, you know, just being surrounded by so many different cultures, I just found myself kind of being a sponge. And so as an extracurricular activity, I ended up, you know, doing stand-up comedy, you know, telling jokes to my friends. And I think you're right. I think it ended up being an escape into these different characters to be able to make people laugh. And it kind of made, you know, kind of made me laugh on the inside as well, because everything on the outside was really, really hurting.
Can you either give us a snippet of a character to be in character, or show how you transition between characters?
Sure. There's a character that is everyone's favorite. His name is Uncle Tony. So Uncle Tony, there's one point in the show, I'll just set up this clip for you because everyone says the show seems like a movie. Uncle Tony is attempting to avoid helping me find my dad because of a devastating family secret. And it goes something like this. Look here, brother man. That explains why you did not receive your letter, brother. I mailed that letter in February, which happens to be Black History Month, the shortest month of the year. I paid 41 cents for postage, my brother. A quarter, a dime, a nickel, and a penny. Now, if you look at the quarter, dime, and the nickel, you would notice that the presidents are faced to the left. On the penny, Abraham Lincoln is faced to the right. Now, why is that? Why did these three presidents turn their back on Abraham Lincoln? Because he helped the black man. That's why they put him on the lowest denomination of currency, the darkest denomination of currency, and the only one that rusts. Uncle Tony. my dad. Can you just give me the information? So that's kind of a little snippet of
oh, yeah.
what I ended up dealing with.
We all have an Uncle Tony who, a little bit of conspiracy theorist, just a little bit.
That's
now,
right.
Now, what was it like doing the shows with Tops in Blue? I mean, what kinds of shows did you put on, and what kind of places did you go when you were in the military to put on these shows?
Oh, my goodness. Tops in Blue. Performing the shows with Tops in Blue was the most amazing experience of my life. It was, to describe the show to you, it was kind of a, if you've seen Bring the Noise, Bring the Funk, kind of a really hip journey of through music. You know, we do, you know, 20s, we do some 50s, we do Motown. It was whatever's on the top of the charts, you would see Tops in Blue perform with a live band, singers and dancers, who were also their own technical crew. Which meant that, you know, being Tops in Blue is the closest you get to being famous and still being in the military, but they keep your head small by making you set up and tear down 50,000 pounds of equipment every single day. So we do 140 locations all over the world. You know, we did Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. We did Okinawa, Japan. My 21st birthday, I spent it in Thule Air Base in Greenland You name it, we were there. But Tops and Blue was formed in 1953 to perform for the troops on the front line. So when we go to the Middle East, Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, Baghdad Airport, those were the shows that meant the most because the troops would be sitting on their tanks watching the show. And that just makes you want to give a little bit more.
What has been the reaction of folks who come to the show who are either in the military or people who even served with you? What do they think?
They have been absolutely amazed. It's been a standing ovation almost every single performance, which I feel really blessed to be able to say, because these are tough times to be paying tickets for anything, you know what I mean, to pay money for anything. So the response to the show has been, A, it needs to be made into a movie and a book, and B, is it true? And you know, where are these people? How can I go see Tops in Blue? And can I send friends to see the show? The New York response has been absolutely overwhelming. And even all over the world, you know, I've taken the show to Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Melbourne, Australia, Vancouver, Canada. No matter where the show is played, it is consistently sold out. And we're loving it.
Yeah, I saw something from your visit to the Fringe Fest in Scotland.
Yes.
And what is it like coming and finding a place in New York's theater world? Because it can be very tough to even get a little purchase in it. But it sounds like you have found a place with your off-Broadway version of the play that's very comfortable and fulfilling.
Well, it is definitely, yeah, I have to admit, I wish I could sit here and say I knew it was going to happen this way. I was nervous waiting for that New York Times review to come out. You know what that's like. You know, it's like, okay, you know, am I going to get the theater God's blessing? Because New York is what it is. It's the Big Apple. It's the biggest theater market in the world. If you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. So it feels really good to have, you know, not just the approval from the critics, but just be able to, you know, I shake everyone's hand who buys a ticket every time I perform my show. I stand at the door as people leave the theater. I shake their hand and look them in the eyes and say thank you. So I really feel like just because the reviews are great, I still know that it's reaching people, and that's what's important to me.
All right, Khalil, thank you.
Thank you.
Khalil Ashanti is the writer and star of Basic Training. It's the off-Broadway one-man show about his life in the Air Force, and it's at the Barrow Street Theater in New York City. He joined us from our NPR studios in New York. After all these years, Marion Wright Edelman still has the fire. She founded the Children's Defense Fund to advocate for children, poor and minority kids especially. Before that, she worked closely with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on his Poor People's Campaign. That's one reason that Barack Obama's election to the White House holds special meaning for her. Obama was also a community organizer and advocate for young people. Marion Wright Edelman also has a new book called The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small. She came by to visit our studios, and I couldn't help asking her, if President-elect Obama came knocking, would she take a seat in his administration?
Of course not. I'm not somebody who could work within government. Everybody likes to go into government. Not everybody. There are many more people who want to be in the cabinet than want to start a movement from the outside. And I think that the gift that I have and the passion that I have is for bringing about a movement that is going to carry on the next phase of what we have to do to finish putting the political, the social and economic underpinnings beneath the political civil rights that Dr. King and so many others fought for. That's my life's work and mission. It is, when you're in government, it's from my point of view, I never could be confined. You have to speak for everybody. You got to be balanced. Children lack a voice. Children need a strong, independent voice that is just about them. And they are the weakest among all the voices. And so I just know that my life's work is to push and mobilize and organize as many people to get what children need. And leaders are made by movements. And while I am so proud of even the thought that Barack Obama will become president of the United States, he's going to be as good a president as we on the outside, as citizens, as mothers and grandmothers, as parents, push him to be. I mean, there's a famous recounting of a meeting between A. Philip Randolph and FDR, when he went in to talk about the need for employment among black citizens and laid out what he thought the agenda was in fighting discrimination. And Franklin Roosevelt told Philip Randolph, I agree with everything you're saying, Philip. Now you go out and make me do it. There are no friends in politics. And in the absence of a strong movement, when he's going to be battered by everybody who wants to stop the war or do global warming or do a new energy policy or do all the special interests, increase the tax cuts for everybody, not just those at the bottom, he's going to have his hands full. And so whoever raises the strongest voice is what's going to be heard. But unless we're out there with clear proposals, a clear constituency, and persistence and a loud voice, children are not going to be able to get what they need, and he's not going to be able to do all the things that he wants. So I think my role is an outside role.
We actually got the chance to talk in a different context, which was the enormous women's conference that Maria Shriver, First Lady of California, threw. And you were in conversation with Gloria Steinem. And I was struck by the reverential way that the women in the audience, mostly women and some men, how they looked at you guys. Is it a burden?
Oh, I don't take it all too seriously. I'm always moved if people think that I have done good work, but I'd rather them not kind of see me as an icon. I'd rather them hear the message and help. And I often get so many people saying, oh, what good, wonderful work you do. Keep it up. And I want to say, help me. We've got to build a movement. And so I don't take it too seriously. I'm grateful. But then the issue is, how do you engage them?
Well, you have this new book, The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small. You reference faith a lot. You have some very specific ideas about that, about how churches and people of faith might serve kids better. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the mandate of the prophets and of the Gospels and of all great faith demand that we do justice and that we speak against oppression or harm to the poor, to the vulnerable, to the orphan, to the widow, to the stranger, to the prisoner. And yet it's so stunning to me that the faith community has lost its prophetic voice and have forgotten the dictates of all of our great faiths and have become, too many of us, puppets of the culture rather than challengers of the culture of violence and of militarism. What would happen if, you know, a third of these churches of God who say they worship a poor baby, I believe God entered history as a poor baby, would just see that they found one adoptive family? We could clean out the child welfare system. How about if 10% of those churches decided they were going to open up and start freedom schools, which is a model we've created for after school and for the summer, to give children safe havens from the streets? The gangs and the drug dealers are open 24/7. Our church doors are too often closed. What if, when we go to prayer meetings on Wednesday night or Tuesday night or Bible study, we decided that we were going to do something about 9 million children who lack health insurance and prenatal care for their mothers and are born at low birth weight? And what if we began to live our faith? I mean, churches and faith congregations, we've seen scandals. They hide domestic violence. They hide child abuse. And the church needs to get away from this prosperity gospel and really begin to reclaim what its faith requires. And so I think one of the great losses and one of the reasons why we've seen a breakdown of family and community and moral values in our society has been the silence and the failure of the church community, of the faith community, to speak up for those who have least.
You've got these four grandchildren. And do they understand what you do for children? And what do they think about it?
Well, my oldest granddaughter is 7. My second granddaughter is 5. And I have 3-year-old twin boys. And one of the proudest moments of my life, I read them books. They read them books about heroines and heroes of the civil rights movement. They've read about Barack Obama. They know about Frederick Douglass. They know about Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman, whom I wear around my neck. But one of the proudest moments of my life was taking Ellica was 5 when Ms. Rosa Parks died. And I took her when she came to the Capitol to stand and wait for Mrs. Parks, and waiting at the Capitol Rotunda as the bus came up, which sent chills through me. And then when Mrs. Parks arrived and watched the integrated honor guard get out and carry Mrs. Parks up the steps, it was just an extraordinary thing to be able to say to my grandchild, you just never forget, as the President of the United States was waiting there and all the congressional leaders, what one black woman can do and what one person can do. But we've got to teach our children their history, white and black and Latino children, and let them know they can make it no matter what.
Speaking of heroines, you have 2 women, as you mentioned, around your neck, Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman, on these these matching ovals, these kind of cameos almost, photographs, one on each side. Why are you wearing them?
Oh, because they give me strength. These are my ancestors, and I used to wear them underneath my clothes. I got these at the New York Historical Society. They had an anti-slavery exhibition. But now I brought them out in this election year because I just thought they should fully participate in everything that's going on, and I think about them all the time. And Harriet Tubman's words and Sojourner Truth's words guide me every day. Because they were strong women who didn't take any guff about mistreatment of women, and they fought for slavery, against slavery, way before Mr. Lincoln and his Emancipation Proclamation came down. And they never forgot their whole community. I mean, when Harriet Tubman went from Maryland to Pennsylvania, she, was glad to be free, but then she realized that she had an obligation to go back and bring some folk up so that she would not be lonely, and she went back numerous times, brought 300 folk up. And we've got in the middle class, and those of us who have been able to walk through the doors of opportunity, we've got to remember Harriet Tubman and not think it's about us, and really try to lift as we climb. And Sojourner just didn't play around. She talked very eloquently and bluntly, and one of my favorite Sojourner statements one day occurred when she was speaking out against slavery, and she got heckled by an old white man who said, oh, slave woman, I don't care anymore about your anti-slavery talk for an old flea bite. And she snapped back at him and said, that's all right, the Lord willing, I'm going to keep you scratching. And so many people try to be big dogs, and we need to bring about big changes. But I've seen the flea corps for children and flea corps for justice for children grow. And enough fleas biting strategically can make the biggest dog uncomfortable. And if black women in all these sororities and all these places that we have so many resources and so much power and all these prayer meetings and all these churches decided they were going to become fleas for children for justice, we could change the world and change the country. So I want everybody to know about Sojourner and Harriet and to become a part of that legacy of women just doing what has to be done to save our children.
That was children's advocate Marion Wright Edelman. Her latest book is called The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small. She joined us here in our studios at NPR West. That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, 30 years ago, more than 900 people died after drinking poison in Jonestown, Guyana. Their pastor, Jim Jones, led the mass suicide and murders as well. We talked to witnesses about the legacy of the tragedy.